Today at Reader's Corner, Scott Anderson, author of Fractured Lands, How the Arab World Came Apart. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Today's guest, Scott Anderson, holds the unique distinction of having a full issue of the New York Times Magazine devoted to his story. That speaks both to the quality of his work as well as to its immense relevance. Mr. Anderson's story, titled Fractured Lands, How the Arab World Came Apart, is now out as a paperback book, and it provides valuable insights into what has happened in the Middle East since the invasion of Iraq, including the subsequent series of anti-government uprisings known as the Arab Spring. While we first cheered these citizen protests, the world is now dealing with the aftermath: a brutal civil war in Syria, Islamic extremists, and a global refugee crisis. Mr. Anderson takes us back to post-World War I to show how history helped shape the events of the past several years and introduces us to people whose lives have been forever altered because of them. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Scott Anderson. He has reported from Lebanon, Israel, Egypt, Northern Ireland, Chechnya, and many other strife-torn countries, and he is a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine. Mr. Anderson is the author of the novels Moonlight Hotel and Triage and several nonfiction books, including the bestseller Lawrence in Arabia, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award in 2014. He joins us by Skype for this interview. Scott Anderson, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob. My pleasure.
You know, it was just recently that I was at a dinner party. In fact, I think it was a few days after we scheduled this interview for your book, Fractured Lands, that a guy sitting next to me leaned over and said, "I finally found something that helped me understand this Middle Eastern thing." I said, "Really? What's that?" He said, "You have to read Lawrence in Arabia." I said, "Well," I said, "actually, I'm going to be interviewing Scott Anderson in what you might call the shorthand version when it comes to figuring out the making of the modern Middle East," as I think your subtitle in that book was. Let's start right there. Could you help us understand how that Arab world of today was stitched together after World War I by those European powers?
Yes. I mean, virtually the entire Arab world prior to World War I was controlled by the Ottoman Empire, by the Turks. And the Ottomans had this unique governing style where they basically gave individual regions and religious groups and ethnic groups almost complete autonomy to rule themselves. As long as you paid your taxes and you met the conscription rate for your district, they pretty much left you alone. Of course, that's not the Western style of rule. It's certainly not an empire. So at the end of World War I, the Ottoman Empire making the fatal mistake of joining with Germany and Austria-Hungary in World War I, the victorious powers of Great Britain and France proceeded to carve up the Ottoman Empire. They gave some limited areas to the Arabs for self-rule, Arabia being the largest one, but then proceeded throughout the rest of the region to carve the Arab world into spheres of influence or outright colonies between Britain and France. And what you're seeing today throughout the Arab world is those countries that were artificially created by Britain and France at the end of World War I, those are the countries that have really sort of, I call it fractured, but have really just kind of come apart. And it's doubtful they'll ever be put back together again.
And you talk about how the Europeans maintained control of these lands, oftentimes teaming up or partnering with hostile tribes, ways of bringing together in these countries people who were not necessarily the majority, but now they were, in fact, in control. Could you help us understand that in the case of Iraq, I think?
Yes, it actually in the case in a lot of places. And that, in fact, it happened throughout the British and French empires. Kind of, it's a classic divide and rule strategy. What you do is you choose a minority tribe or ethnic group or religious group, and you empower them as your local administrator. So you kind of put them on the top of the pyramid above everybody else. That elite tribe or ethnic group, they can never rebel against you, you being the British or the French, because they're now hated by the majority below them. So this was a standard practice they used throughout the world, and you see it now playing out in the Arab world. You mentioned Iraq. In Iraq, it's a majority Shia country. The British empowered the Sunnis. In fact, they brought in a Sunni king who had actually never even been to Iraq in 1920 to make him the king. In Syria, just the opposite. It is a majority Sunni country, and the Alawites of the ruling Assad dynasty, the Alawites are an offshoot of Shia. So you see this pattern play out again and again. And of course, when the imperial power leaves, when the empire collapses, it's just a recipe for essentially for civil war.
Boy, it's so frustrating reading your book. I mean, it's like you could have subtitled it "The Chickens Coming Home to Roost" when you look at what's going on around the world today. So you used a very unique approach in telling this story. Again, Lawrence in Arabia is to some extent the story of T.E. Lawrence. But here in this book, you're focused on six people whose lives have been upended by the series of crises across the Arab world. How did you find these six people?
When the New York Times came to me with this project in mind, I dangled the idea that if I found a compelling enough story, I'd get the whole issue. Of course, I said yes, but then I started thinking, well, how am I going to get readers to want to follow a story that's 40,000 words, over 100 typewritten pages? And I realized the only way I could do it was to tell stories, to kind of follow a small group of people. And to follow their lives over the course of these years when so much has happened in the Middle East. So I and the photographer I've worked with for two decades, Paolo Pellegrin, it became a kind of treasure hunt. I knew the type of people I needed. I didn't want famous people. I wanted people who would be willing to spend a lot of time with me and, to really open up to me. And it also needed to be people for whom dramatic things had happened over this course of time. So in that way, you might get a somewhat skewered idea of in following these six people's lives of, this is not necessarily a typical experience for people, but I needed people who, have really lived these years deeply in their lives, have been very affected by them. So it took 2 years. I'd made four extended trips to the region and probably interviewed scores and scores of people before I found the people I ended up choosing. I wanted a mix of people. I wanted a mix of genders. So there's two women, and it's very difficult as a male journalist to get women in the Arab world to talk at all, let alone to really open up to you. And I wanted, of course, a regional mix from different places and different experiences.
Well, it's just amazing that as I read these vignettes of their lives, how difficult it is for them to survive in their own countries. When it's all said and done, years later, like this year, where are these six people? Are any of them still in their home countries? How many of them have become refugees themselves and now find themselves living in Germany, as I know one does?
Right. Actually, two are now refugees. The woman who's in, as you mentioned, Germany. She's in Austria, Kulod. Amaj, the Syrian college student, he's in Germany. Wakaz, who is the ISIS fighter, who I interviewed in a prison, is almost certainly dead. Almost everybody from the secret prison he was being held in northern Iraq, almost everybody from that prison was executed a few months ago. And I'm almost certain that Wakaz, he was rather notorious even for that prison because he had talked about executing six people. So he's almost certainly dead. And the others are still in their countries. Azar, the Kurdish doctor, he has stayed in Kurdistan. And Amajdi, the Libyan, is there. And Layla, who's a human rights activist in Cairo, in Egypt, she's there and still trying to work on getting her son out of prison.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking with Scott Anderson, author of Fractured Lands, How the Arab World Came Apart. The U.S. may have some image issues today in the Middle East, but you help us understand in the book that wasn't always the case. And again, going back to the end of World War I, help us understand how the United States was viewed in the Middle East at that time.
It's kind of an astonishing story. So at the end of World War I, when the Arab world saw this design that the British and the French were going to come in as imperial powers, President Wilson, who was opposed to empires continuing, but met such fierce resistance from the British and French that he said, okay, well let's have a plebiscite. Let's send somebody to interview people in the region and find out what they actually want. Kind of a novel idea for the time. So Wilson appointed this commission called the King Crane Commission, and in the fall of 1919, this group of Americans, 8 or 9 of them, went on this tour throughout the what today is Syria, Lebanon, Israel, and southern Turkey. Basically, had a series of town hall meetings and talked to just a vast array of people. And the overwhelming consensus wherever they went was, number one, people wanted independence. And if they couldn't have independence, they wanted an American kind of governorship. They didn't want the British, and they certainly didn't want the French. And so and they were actually saw America as this non-imperial power that could kind of take them under their wing. By the time this commission got back to Paris, back to the Paris peace talks, Wilson had already kind of lost interest in what was happening in the Middle East. And so their report, really kind of a damning report, but showing the unanimity of people wanting independence, their report was just put away in a vault for 3.5 years. It was kind of the Pentagon Papers of their day. And it was finally published by the New York Times about 3 or 4 years later. So that's the kind of amazing first American involvement, if you will, within the region. But it also established an interesting, and it is a pattern with American involvement in the region, which is this tendency to raise hopes, to fixate on what's happening in the region, and then to get up and walk away. And, this isn't a Democrat or Republican thing. This has been kind of across the board of American administrations for as long as we've been in the region. The most, probably the latest example being Iraq, the American invasion of Iraq.
We know that the invasion of Iraq made the U.S. very unpopular in the Middle East, but you also contend that it could have been a catalyst for the Arab Spring. How's that?
I think why the American invasion was such a destabilizing influence was that for the first time you had one of these autocrats, one of these dictators who had been in power for decades, toppled. And these dictators existed all across the Middle East. And, in some places, people had been in power. Muammar Gaddafi, who I interviewed right before the American invasion, he'd been in power before he was toppled for almost 40 years. So there's this complete political stasis or fossilization, if you will, throughout the Middle East. And what the American invasion did was all of a sudden make it possible. It almost just on a psychological level in people's minds that somebody who was seemingly immovable as Saddam Hussein could be overthrown. And that had this kind of percolating effect throughout the region. Unfortunately, the Americans had no idea how to capitalize on that kind of destabilizing effect, nor was it clear that they really had any interest in fostering political change throughout the region.
This is almost an aside, but just recently we had Ambassador Casey Kavanaugh on our campus. He was the first ambassador to Georgia. But in explaining to students how diplomacy has changed, he talked about how it's no longer state to state, and it's to some extent state to business that is keeping track of these large Russian tycoons in his neck of the woods, so to speak. And he points out in Egypt it became state to culture. The American diplomats trying to figure out what was happening in the square, and he points out that social media oftentimes can be a very difficult way to assess the depth of dissatisfaction among a people, because we don't really know how to measure social media today. But clearly, Egypt was one of your case examples.
That's right. And I mean, the one thing that social media absolutely does, and Arab Spring is probably the prime example of that, is that you can't with social media, you can't bottle up your people anymore. With the exception of North Korea. Even in a rigid police state like you had in Syria, they very quickly found out through YouTube and Facebook what was happening in Libya and what was happening in Egypt. So it had, very quickly had this kind of firestorm effect throughout the region. But the ambassador is exactly right. And one thing that I've been kind of stunned by as I travel through the region, what I always try to do is get as far out of the country and get away from the capital as I can. But when you see American diplomats, it's the age-old complaint that they sit around and go to cocktail parties in the capital and they think that they understand the country. But what's happened since September 11 is that in so many of these places, for their own security, perceived or imaginary danger that they're in, so many American embassies abroad now are essentially, you know, fortified bunkers, and the people stationed there never leave, or they go out in a bulletproof convoy and rush over to the Ministry of Information or the presidential palace. And that's you know, the sum total of their involvement with the country. So, of course, they don't understand what's happening, you know, beneath the surface.
So you mentioned your interview with Gaddafi, and I think that was in 2002. Were there many Western journalists that were getting inside Gaddafi's office for an interview, number one? Number two, tell us about that interview, especially the part where you ask him, so what happens if we invade Iraq?
Right. I had been trying to get an interview with Gaddafi for about 3 or 4 years, and I'm convinced that the reason I finally got it, you're right, it was in the fall of 2002, was the drumbeat to invade Iraq was clearly on, and there was talk, you know, within the Bush administration that once we got rid of Saddam Hussein, Muammar Gaddafi was going to be next. So I think Gaddafi felt, you know, it was time for a little charm offensive on Gaddafi's part. So I got this interview. And I spent about 3 weeks in Libya. I had a very long interview with Gaddafi at his fortified barracks in Tripoli. And as crazy as Gaddafi seemed, there certainly is eccentric in a lot of ways. But the thing that really always struck me is I asked him, I said, so if the Americans do invade Iraq, who benefits? And up until then, Gaddafi, whenever I'd ask a question, he did this kind of theatrical thing of taking a long pause and sort of gazing up at the palm trees above us, kind of presenting himself as this philosopher king. And when I asked that, so who benefits in an American invasion? He instantly said Al-Qaeda, that if the Americans invade Iraq, it'll be a call to Islamic extremists throughout the region. They'll come and they will declare war. They'll declare jihad on America. And as I said, as crazy as Gaddafi was in a number of ways, he was absolutely accurate about that. He saw it coming.
Well, given how long he was there, let's talk about that, because you discuss in your book a concept called a culture of grievance in the Arab world, which may well have contributed to those many years of dictatorship. Explain that.
Yeah, you know, I've been covering war for 25 years now. Actually, even a bit longer than that, I guess. But wherever else I've been in the world, you know, if I'm talking to an FMLN guerrilla in El Salvador or a Tamil tiger in Sri Lanka, and I ask them what you were fighting for, I always got an answer. It might be an absolutely sophomoric answer or absurd one. They could always kind of articulate what they were fighting for. And in the Arab world, what I saw again and again was it was always what they were fighting against, not for. And it may seem a semantic difference, but I actually think it's a huge difference. And that goes to this idea of this culture of grievance, that their lot in life is the result of the injustices perpetrated on them, usually by the outside. So it goes back to the imperial powers. It goes back to the borders that were imposed, rightly, stupid borders that were imposed at the end of World War I, artificial borders. So it stems from that. It stems from American support of Israel. Of course, the existence of Israel itself, the Western support of Israel. So, and what I feel is dictators over these years were very adroit at channeling local rage to these external enemies. And if it wasn't the West, if it wasn't the Zionists, if it wasn't the Americans, if it wasn't the imperialists, it would be the next door neighbor. But you saw again and again with these dictators that they were very clever in channeling popular discontent away from their own misrule and to some outside boogeyman. And all of a sudden, with the Arab Spring, that didn't work anymore. And what was fascinating is how they tried to play. You know, this was a card they've been playing for decades. So when the revolution started in Syria, Hafez al-Assad buses a bunch of Palestinian refugees up to Golan Heights and gets the Israelis to kind of shoot at them, hoping that all of a sudden that's going to be this galvanizing thing that the Syrian people will remember. Oh wait, we hate Israel more than anything. You know, let's all rally around the flag and, you know, hate Israel again. It didn't work. And, you know, people saw through it. And Gaddafi tried a similar thing in Libya. It just didn't work anymore.
Mm-hmm. I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner, and my guest is Scott Anderson, author of Fractured Lands, which looks at how the Arab world came apart in the years following the Iraq War. So take us back to Tunisia in December of 2010. This is where the Arab Spring started. What happened?
It's the wings of a butterfly starting a hurricane. What happened was a young fruit seller, he had a push cart in a provincial city in Tunisia. He had been being harassed by the police, probably getting hit up for small bribes. They took his, at one point, the police just took his push cart away from him, kind of denying him the ability to make a living. He burned himself. He set himself on fire. He went out in front of the municipal building and killed himself. And very quickly throughout Tunisia, and Tunisia being one of the, it was a dictatorship, but certainly by the standards of the region, a rather benign one. So very quickly, there were protests all around the country, protesting at first police corruption, governmental corruption, but then very quickly it turned into a call for the overthrow of the dictator. And the dictator, after very little bloodshed, quit, left the country. By then, it had already leapfrogged, the Arab Spring had already leapfrogged to Egypt to protest against Mubarak, Hosni Mubarak, the dictator. And then within a few weeks after that, had also jumped to Libya, to Yemen. And again, so much of this was about social media. This, the availability of those images that 10 years before, those populations in those countries, certainly the poor people in those countries, never would have seen any of that, because the only media outlet you had was the state-run television and radio. And again, that didn't work anymore.
So how could something so promising go so wrong?
I think my personal feeling is that it has a lot to do with this kind of, it's partly this culture of grievance. It's the political fossilization that had gone on there for years. So there had, in country after country, there had really been no political discussion of what was going to take the place of the dictator. And it also ties in with the idea of these artificial countries, these countries forged and thrown together by the British and the French. So when the glue of the dictatorship comes off or starts to fray, people revert back to their ethnic or their religious sect. And you saw that play out again and again. And why I think why I spent some time in Fractured Lands talking about the history of 100 years ago, is what you see now in the Arab world is the three countries that now are so split apart that it's really doubtful they will ever be put back together. And that's Libya, Syria, and Iraq. Those are also the three countries that were absolute artificial creations created after World War I by the British and the French. And it's not a coincidence. So Egypt is now a very repressive police state, but Egypt, they have a national consciousness that goes back 3,000, 4,000 years. Whatever happens in Egypt, the country itself is not going to rip apart. It's not going to become mini states like the way Syria and Iraq is. So I think all those factors kind of came together in this lethal brew, and not least being this that after 40, 50 years of these brutal dictatorships in cases like Syria or Iraq, there had been no dialogue. There was absolutely no consensus of where you go from here.
So we touched briefly, very briefly, on the six people that you interviewed and spent the bulk of your book discussing. Let's just take one or two. We're running out of time here, but I want you to tell us about Dr. Azar Merkan, if that's the way you pronounce his name.
Yep.
And his story, what it tells us about the daily life of Iraqis, and are you still in touch with him?
Yeah, Azar, he is a doctor, a urologist, actually, in Kurdistan. And he comes from a warlord family. The Kurds have this long tradition of being mountain warriors, and his Merkan family was a rather illustrious one. So when ISIS, 3 years ago, in 2014, when ISIS started pushing into Kurdistan, he and his brothers, all in their highly educated professional family, actually, a lot of his brothers are in the States as doctors. They all rushed home and took up weapons to fight against ISIS. And in Azar's case, he quit his medical practice, and even today has not gone back to medicine. But he's continuing to fight against ISIS. He was when I had met him, he just a couple of months before, he'd been shot in the hand by an ISIS sniper, and he was working to try to recover his hand. And one of the first things they asked him, I said, "You're always doing these like hand exercises." I said, "Oh, you're trying to get your hand back to do surgery." And he said, "No, my days of surgery are over. No, I need to get my trigger hand back." So I spent about altogether, I spent about 6 weeks on the front lines with the Kurdish soldiers, with Azar, in the front lines against ISIS. And this was just before the offensive to push back against ISIS in places like Mosul and Raqqa.
By the way, I was reading that section of the book where you're with him, and all of a sudden it occurs to me, wait a minute, Scott Anderson is with this guy. He's moving through some very dangerous territory here. I mean, you really put yourself in some peril, not just to track these folks down and interview them, but in some cases anyway, in this case, traveling with them in what had to be pretty scary circumstances.
Yeah, there were moments that were a little scary. And of course, ever being around ISIS, it adds a whole new element of kind of terror.
I guess.
But I also feel like and it goes back to my thing of I have to get out in the field with these people. I have to, I can't interview them in my hotel lobby. I need to share their lives. So in all these cases, it was as much as possible was not only spending like big blocks of time, because that. What I've also found as a journalist, that's really the only way to get people to really open up to you, but to also experience what their lives are. Mm-hmm. So in the case of Maj, this Syrian college student, I kept in touch with him by email. And when he got to Germany and he was given temporary asylum there, I went to Germany to interview him. But along with interviewing him, I spent 3 or 4 days in the town where he's living now. This one day we went on this long hike up in the mountains and we didn't talk about Syria. We didn't talk about the war at all. It was kind of this bonding thing that I felt was necessary.
Well, in your epilogue, and we'll conclude with this question, in your epilogue, you talk about what you've learned from this experience and you mention the power of the individual. And I believe you refer to Khulod, the woman in her early 20s when she began to advocate and work for causes for women in Iraq. And yet you're concerned about this because these are the people that can make a difference and rebuild these countries. But, well, I'll let you finish the sentence.
Yeah. I'm Khulod is – I think of all of the people I met on this trip. Khulod, she's a Iraqi Shia woman in her mid-30s. She was the most inspiring to me because she came up from a provincial city in southern Iraq. She's the youngest daughter in a Shia Arab family. So – there is absolutely no reason for this woman to be a leader, but she is. And in fact, her family is alive today because again and again and again, Khulod was the one who stepped forward and did something that saved her family. And now she and one of her sisters are living in Austria. She's still trying to get her father and her other sister to join them. So, I just think that her story was absolutely amazing. But of course, now she's in Austria. And to your point of how I finished the book, immigrants are always the best and the brightest of a country. I mean, that was true about the Italians who came over in the 1920s or the Irish in the 1870s. It's the people with the gumption to get up and try for a better life. And that's true today with the Syrians and the Iraqis who are leaving the area. These are the people who will not accept the status quo. Sadly, though, it is exactly those people who you need to bring about change in those countries. So my long-term outlook on the region is a pretty bleak one because I think what you're seeing, you look at a place like Syria, and not only the hundreds of thousands who have been killed, but the now millions who have gone elsewhere and who are going to start new lives in Germany or Sweden or Austria or here, and they're not going back.
Scott Anderson, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book, Fractured Lands, How the Arab World Came Apart. And when you finish that one, go back and read Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. Great to have you with us today, Scott.
Thank you, Rob. My pleasure.
Uh-huh. Take care now. I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Scott Anderson. Next week, Lisa Servan, author of The Unbanking of America, How the New Middle Class Survives. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.